Hello and welcome to another episode here at the Damage Report. A big day potentially. We've got some important news to start the show off with in just a little bit. Today might go as planned. It might go as a few of the craziest people in the country have planned. We'll have to stay tuned and find out. But along the way with that news, as well as a number of other stories, we've got Adrian Lawrence joining us once again. Adrian, how's it going?
It's going good. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. You may not know, but while we have you here, we also have you in the emojis, now available on YouTube. An awesome Adrian emojis there. I can see the Bitchkin Chicken Chicken Dragon is sharing a bunch of Adrian's. People very excited to see you. So yeah, let's flood the chat with Adrian's. Anyway, Adrian, always glad to have you here. How have you been doing?
Oh man, it has been a struggle. Like 2021 will not release its grips. It's very much on that 2020 tip. But I guess things are somewhat getting better in society. So hey, that's something I have to look forward to.
Oh God, maybe 2022, holding out hopes for it. Well, that's probably too early. 2023, that's gonna be a good year. Anyway, I saw one question about the audio. So I don't know if we can see if anybody else is having any problems with the audio. It sounds good according to me, but what do I know? Anyway, Adrian, thank you for being here. Thank you everybody for being here, regardless of what platform you're watching on. Thank you for being here. Please hit the like button and share the stream so that more people know that we're live. As I said, we've got a lot to talk about. We're gonna be talking about the stimulus bill. We're gonna be talking about HR1. We're gonna be talking about Dr. Seuss. We're gonna be talking about so much. Updates on Governor Cuomo, who's apparently not stepping down. That's a real shocker. So lots of news to get to, Adrian. Why don't we jump into this? The House is not in session today. It was actually canceled because of a Capitol Police warning about another possible plot to breach the Capitol or blow up the Capitol, basically to kill a bunch of people. And this is, of course, coming from a combination of QAnon people and domestic terror groups that call themselves militias and a number of other things like that. And it's basically all centered around this idea that Donald Trump is going to be inaugurated once again as president today. Why do they believe that? Because America has a very large undiagnosed mental health problem. There's more to it too that they would say is why they believe it, but that's fundamentally why they believe it. So anyway, Capitol Police are preparing for another assault today. They have intelligence on a potential plot by a militia group. It's entirely possible that nothing will happen because some officials describe the threats as more aspirational than operational. It's a lot of people saying they hope that the Capitol is destroyed today rather than saying that they're necessarily the ones who are going to do it. So bear in mind nothing could happen, but also bear in mind that I believe on the morning of January 6th, I said that things are probably gonna go pretty smoothly. So you never know actually how it's gonna go, Adrian. What are your thoughts?
You know what, it's so interesting to me how these people purport to be patriots and really wanting democracy. And then at the same time, they're out here saying, oh, we hope the Capitol gets blown up. And you know, it really resonates with me, the fact that there are people who just want anarchy. And if that's what you want, just say it, but don't do it under the guise of purporting to reestablish the democracy. Because that's just, you know, it's a complete and total farce. And I'm mystified with how our law enforcement, unfortunately, doesn't seem to be taking it as seriously. You know, it's like when we have black and brown people marching down the street, like they're completely prepared and they are using all sorts of mechanisms to stop this. But then when we have white people rushing the Capitol and instances like this, it's kind of one of those of can't be that bad. And it ends up hurting us all. And we need not to have that to be the case.
Definitely. Now, I've alluded to some of the, I don't know what word to use. It's not philosophy. It's not, what is it, the thinking that's going on right now about how America's technically a corporation? And so how for like 150 years, the president's haven't been the president, they've been the CEO of America, which is how Donald Trump is gonna become. Look, it's complicated. So why don't we go to the actual sources for this information. Here is some footage that CNN took at a Trump rally.
My hope that President Trump comes back as the 19th president of the United States under the 1776, and that he is inaugurated on March 4th. That is my hope for our future.
Feel foolish on March 5th when Biden's still president?
Then Trump has a different plan than Clay.
Everybody keeps saying Trump has a plan. He has a plan. When he lost the election, they said he has a plan. He's still going to stay up.
Trump didn't lose the election, sir.
But he did.
Trump did not lose the election. And that's where we differ.
Right.
And that's where I believe the information that Mike Lindell has put out.
The pillow guy.
Of all of the abuse, corruption, stealing.
So you trust the man? You trust the man more who sells pillows than the Republican officials in Georgia?
Oh, absolutely.
The military is in charge. It's going to be like Myanmar. What's happening in Myanmar? The military is doing their own investigation, and at the right time, they're going to be restoring the republic with Trump as president.
So, look, maybe it's just a couple of people that they're having a tough time mentally and emotionally in response to what's going on. Maybe that's what it is, but lots of people do believe the things that those people were saying there. Adrian, under 1776, he's gonna come back, and the military is going to, they're gonna do like Myanmar, which she cited as a good thing. And they're going to bring Trump back. But understand that QAnon also believes that Biden is only there because the deep state put him there, which is simultaneously the military, but not the military, depending on whether it needs to be the military at any given point. So like the military is the bad guy, and they will also bring back Trump. Oh, what are we supposed to do? Is this a waste of time? Should we just ignore this?
I think it can be very dangerous to ignore it, because there, like you mentioned, there are a lot of people who believe these theories. And as these conspiracy theories continue to grow, so do people's kind of insistence that they are true and that they need to do something to save the system. And these people have been indoctrinated. Like, this is dangerous, because, you know, just because they're not necessarily, working with a full deck, doesn't mean that they can't do damage, as we've seen before, and it doesn't mean that they won't do damage.
Yeah, and like I don't believe that either of those two women is going to be storming the Capitol, although plenty of people that looked indistinguishable from them did. So perhaps I should be a little bit more worried about that. But it also kind of bothers me that there's a lot of people who are just sort of passively waiting for people to start getting executed, and they're looking forward to that. And speaking about it, in let's make this explicit. Everything that especially the woman with the hat said was just religious speak. That's all it was. She was talking about Mike Lindell rather than some priest, and she was talking about Trump rather than some god. But everything that she just said was an expression of religious belief about the infallibility of her leader, and how you have to have faith, and that's how you generate. Like, that's all it. She wasn't talking about this like a person talks about politics or about particular politicians. And that makes me extremely, I guess, pessimistic about the possibility of trying to get through to this person. They're not exercising the same mental or cognitive tools for determining fact from fiction. She has a story that she likes, and everything will work out. If Trump doesn't get re-inaugurated, which he definitely will, but if he doesn't, then he works in mysterious ways. He has some other plan. And who am I, a mere mortal, to be able to figure that out, Adrian?
Yeah, and the thing that you also need to consider is that Trump has a son, multiple sons, some of which we don't even know about, or he doesn't even know about. But you know, the son could be the second coming for Trump. And this mentality, all of these theories, they're so dangerous, because people who are people who are soccer moms or just basic everyday people are actually believing them. And they are out here promulgating this message and pushing for it to actually come to fruition. This is scary.
It is. And so Donald Trump thus far has been silent about March 4th, which, look, in theory, if you're a person who believes that he's going to be reinaugurated, I mean, it would be kind of cool if he was saying something. It's weird that he's not. But more importantly, I guess, there are all these concerns about the possibility for violence. There are all these different online groups that are talking about storming the Capitol or destroying the Capitol and all of that. And you'll note that Trump is not telling those people who love and worship him, he's not telling them not to do that. Which again brings to mind January 6th, where we have all of these concerns that something terrible is going to happen. And the president is just, or the former president in this case, is just sitting on the sidelines, waiting to see what happens. And that's it. And if some of these people do go through with this, if they set off some bombs or something like that, Trump will maybe begrudgingly say something after the fact, after the damage has been done, after the people have died. And Fox will be saying that how could anyone have possibly known it wasn't his responsibility, even though he could go on TV right now and tell them not to do anything, and yet he's not. And I want to play a bit of video. This is Representative Michael McCaul, a Republican, talking about Trump's obligation to do something about his people.
Yeah, I think President Trump has a responsibility to tell them to stand down. This threat is credible and it's real. It's a right-wing militia group that believes that because the original inaugural date was March 4th until the 20th Amendment passed, they think this is the true inauguration day and that President Trump should be inaugurated tomorrow. And that is the threat we face right now.
Okay, I mean that's good of Michael McCaul, who was the chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security for 3 terms. Glad they said that. Trump hasn't said anything. Let's keep it real. He's not gonna say anything. And so what's gonna happen is gonna happen. Probably nothing is gonna happen, but maybe something terrible will happen and maybe more people will lose their lives like they did last month.
Yeah, and it's the thing that really gets me is that we saw this coming. We knew it. A lot of us said, hey, this is a problem. These people are being indoctrinated. They're starting to believe these far out conspiracy theories and to act on them. And yet those concerns were never taken seriously. And now here we are, where we are fearing for our safety. We're wondering where this is gonna go, but still it feels like these things aren't necessarily being taken seriously. So it makes you ask, what needs to happen in order for our leadership to say, you know what, we need to cut this out, whether we need to start curbing regulations, we need to do it because people's lives are actually in danger.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
If you thought the Democratic stimulus bill was bad, wait until you find out what they did to it over the past 24 hours or so. So, Senate Democrats have this newly adopted framework where individuals earning $75,000 per year or less and married couples earning $150,000 or less based on either their 2019 or 2020 income would still receive the full aforementioned $1,400 payments, but the checks would phase out more quickly for people whose earnings exceed these thresholds. And I just can't believe that we're once again going through the threshold thing and the micro targeting. And Adrian, we already did this. Didn't we have like a week long debate about what the threshold should start at, how quickly it should go out? And they were gonna cut it down and there was a bunch of pushback, so they backed off of it. And I guess that's good for like 3 weeks, and now we're back to that yet again. Can't they give us a couple of minutes to process the complete betrayal of their pledge to raise the minimum wage before they then do in this thing about the phasing out again?
No, of course not, because we really don't matter. They're just kind of like pandering to us in this moment. And the reality is that people continue to suffer. The class divide widens and people can't even survive off of $15 minimum wage if that even were to occur. And having MIT come forward with all of its research and studies saying, hey, this wouldn't even work if we got here. You know, hey, they want to continue to ignore the facts, the research, the scientists, because they want to continue to keep this class divide and keep people impoverished, which doesn't sound like good leadership to me.
No, it doesn't. And AOC is pointing that out. She echoed many of our own thoughts, saying, I don't understand the political or economic wisdom in allowing Trump to give more people relief checks than a Democratic administration. People went far too long without relief last year. If anything, we should be more generous, not more stingy. And like, she's 100% right. It's a little bit worse even than she's explicitly talking about there, because it's not like they have to do this to get Republicans on board to pass the bill. No Republican is going to support this, no matter what is in the bill. And they already know that they're going to pass it through reconciliation, the only way that they possibly could. And it's not even that they have to do this, I don't think, to get the needed Democrats to pass it. I could be wrong. I believe it is exactly as likely to pass in either case. So why are they doing it? Why are they taking a bill that has already been dragged out for months and months, that we already went through the $2,000 thing? We already went through now the minimum wage thing, and they're just deciding, you know what, before we finish this, how could we make it slightly worse? How could we generate another couple days news cycle about how Senate Democrats are the ones that are choosing to give less people aid? And so they're doing it. So I don't know, Adrian, if you have a theory as to, unless you disagree about the likelihood of passage thing, if it's not that, then what is the reason that they're doing this?
I really don't know. I think you're absolutely right. The observations you've made, as well as AOC, like this is shenanigans. This isn't good leadership. There are people in need. The fact that they're not getting the stimulus they need, there's no even real consideration of raising the minimum wage. It's keeping people impoverished during a time when they need it the most. And it's really shocking to me, in part because we know how the economy works. That we do need a working class. We need people to be able to have a roof over their head if they're gonna continue to work and do what they need to do. And it's almost like our leadership doesn't want the nation to actually survive. One way or the other, it's really, really an issue.
And let's give people information about how many fewer people. So AOC referred to the fact that Trump will have given checks to more people. So what effect does this most recent change have? Well, according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, the new eligibility framework pushed by conservative Senate Democrats and accepted by the party leadership, which means at the end of the day that Joe Biden is totally fine with it and all of that, would result in around 12 million fewer adults and 5 million fewer children receiving direct payments compared to the eligibility structure proposed by the House. That is a massive chunk of people who are going to have thought now for months that they're gonna get this check, because they had been told for months that they're gonna get this check, and then they're not gonna get the check. And who do you think they're gonna blame? Trump, for months ago, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell? No, and they shouldn't. They shouldn't. The Republicans have, as far as we can tell, nothing to do with this. This is entirely the Democrats, and they can say there that it's the conservative Senate Democrats that are pushing for it. That only, like, putting it all on them only makes sense if you honestly believe that Joe Manchin would vote against the bill if they didn't do this, or if they, you know, didn't remove the minimum wage or something like that. And maybe you think that. But if you believe that he would still not want to be the one that tanks the entire thing for the entire country, then this is not necessary. which means that it's optional, which means that those who are bargaining with these conservative Senate Democrats, like Joe Biden and like, I guess, Chuck Schumer and others, they are seemingly okay with this, with having 12 million adults around the country that are going to be pissed off at them, totally justifiably. Whether, like, and they should get the money because they desperately need the money. But even if you somehow believed that America is just full of people that through this pandemic have been doing just fine, pragmatically, to tell people you're going to give them this and then not give it to them, how could that possibly not hurt you politically? So whether for moral reasons or for pragmatic political reasons, why would you do any of what they're doing right now?
I think that's a really, really great question. And you do have to wonder, what are they thinking? Are they even thinking? It really hits home the fact that we have this, again, this class divide where it's a matter of, do these Democrats really even care? But don't let, you know, whether someone has an R or a D behind their name, signify or assume that it means that they actually care about these divides that we have and the issues that are ongoing. And this really hammers at home.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to, we've talked a couple of times about the minimum wage. Let's talk a little bit about that and the implications of what's going on politically around that. After so many promises, the Democrats have apparently scrapped plans to add the minimum wage increase, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. It's no longer going to be in the COVID bill. They've scrapped it. So that means that the current national wage floor, which is $7.25 an hour, assuming you're not a tipped worker, in which case you'll make even less than that. But what's the difference? That's only like tens of millions of people. You could end up just making that $15,000 a year before tax. And this article, CNBC says, it'll likely remain in place for the short term. For the short term, what, like 2 weeks? If it's not in this, come on. What, is it passing in April? Why? Why would it pass in April? Why would the Republican Party, which would have vigorously opposed it under reconciliation, why would they cross over and support it later? Now, we've got a lot more to get to, but I want to stay on this point for just 1 second. Adrian, do you think that they're, when they say short term, if it is not under a bill that the Democrats can pass without the fear of a filibuster, do you believe that there is any chance that they'll pass it this year or before the midterms?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, I do, again, think that they're kind of just pandering to us to try to make us go away in this moment, but it will never get done if it doesn't get done now. And the thought that people aren't going to support this, oh man, it's absolutely astonishing if you're actually in this position to help people, because there are so many people out there. We have nearly 32 million workers would see an increase in their pay to not even close to a living wage, but a lot closer than $7.25 an hour if they make that change. But that's not happening.
Yeah. And so what does that mean in practice? Well, currently the current minimum wage doesn't cover the cost of living for full-time workers in any US state, according to cost of living data published by researchers at MIT. So they very helpfully put together a little infographic of the states, and you can see there that you'd have to get into the green for it to be a living wage. It doesn't reach it in any of those states. There are some where it comes a little bit closer, but it's not even particularly close in any of the states. And here's the most amazing thing. At many points over the past month or so, we have talked about how the plan to raise it to $15 an hour is simultaneously not some insane commie plot, and it's not nearly as much as workers actually deserve. And I think to really demonstrate that, let's do this same infographic, but for a $15 wage. It isn't a living wage in a ton of states even then. Like, you're doing better. You don't have any of those dark blues, and it is a living wage or a little bit more in some states. Generally, it looks like in the middle swath of the country. But even there, if you were to double it, you still wouldn't have a living wage, which means that to literally make ends meet, people have to work far, far, far more than a full-time job. And it's very easy for wealthy people, mostly Republicans, but a ton of Democrats too, to say, well, what's the difference? It's just kids or whatever. And I'm so sick of having to respond to that idea that the only people getting minimum wage are kids, or that if it was just kids, well, they don't deserve any sort of recognition or consideration anyway. And so they have to work far more hours doing the sorts of jobs that the vast majority of the people who are opposing a $15 minimum wage wouldn't want to do for 1 hour a week, let alone 60 or 80 or 100. And so, Adrian, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are very much aligned with yours. As I mentioned, that it would affect at least 32 million workers. And also, you know, being a black woman, I pay attention to things that impact race. And there's research out there that shows that the failure to sufficiently raise the minimum wage from 1979 to 2009, that led to an over 50% increase in inequality between women in the middle and lower class. And it impacts women of color the most. And so we have this entire demographic that is unable to really just have this living wage standards and to support themselves. And it's like that's almost intentional at this point, because you know who is suffering the most, that it's people of color and women. But for some reason, the leaders in the United States is like, oh, that's cool, let them suffer.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, let's say hypothetically, it didn't have an outsized impact on either women or people of color or women of color. I think they would still hate it because they like violently hate the working class. But especially since that's true, they have no interest whatsoever in it. And thus, even after the Democrats gaining control of both houses of Congress and the White House after winning multiple elections in a row and just winning election after election and special election after special election, the best we can do is it seemed like we were close kind of for a little bit, and then not so much, even though they could totally do it. They could totally do it right now if they wanted to. The parliamentarian is not some adamantium wall between them and what they say are their political goals. It's advice. I give them advice all the time, and they seem very comfortable ignoring that. Somehow they can't see fit to overrule the parliamentarian. And so if they're not doing it here, and if we believe that there's basically no chance of them overruling the filibuster, it seems like it might be a pretty uneventful couple of years, Adrian. Yep. And then maybe the midterms will go like they generally historically go. And then, well, that'll be exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially being this close, which is why, hey, like I said before, don't let that R or D that follows someone's name really make you think that they must believe one thing or the other. Because the reality is, it's all in the actions, and the actions here aren't supporting these people who are generally what we consider essential workers during this pandemic. And no, they're allowed to starve and to struggle. And There's nothing democratic, there's nothing right or just about that.
Yeah. Ugh. Things were supposed to be better in some way with the new year.
2020, man.
Not so much. Got a little bit. Every once in a while, someone will send in a message saying that they got vaccinated. That's nice. Yeah. And WandaVision has been pretty good. And that's about it.
2025
too. Yeah, oh God. The House passed a pretty good bill yesterday. It is the For the People Act, a sweeping bill that seeks to change campaign finance, voting, and ethics laws. The bill would expand access to the ballot box by creating automatic voter registration across the country, restoring the voting rights of the formerly incarcerated, expanding early voting, and modernizing America's voting systems. And because it does all of those things, every one of which is the essence of common sense, it narrowly passed the House 220 to 210 with one Democrat joining all Republican House members in voting against it. Because like honestly, the one Democrat like crossing over at least made this a little bit interesting. Is there any bill that isn't 100% along party lines at this point? Even something like, hey, let's let people vote. Anyway, Adrian, it passed. It's got some good stuff. We're going to talk about more provisions of it, but this is the sort of thing I would want Democrats to be trying to pass, and at least in the House, they did it.
Yes, and I'm sure they're going to pat themselves on the backs for it and kind of say, whew, I'm done for the season. That was good. Was it good for you? And as a result of that, I'm concerned that nothing else progressive is going to get done that will advance us in any way, because they'll feel like, hey, they threw us a little nugget here. But I do appreciate some of what's in the People Act. So I will leave it to you to dive in.
Yeah, and I will in one sec, but let's, like, you're totally right. that it's a nugget being thrown to us. But I would argue the nugget hasn't even been thrown to us yet. Like, if it passed, maybe we could consider, like in the Senate as well, and it was signed into law and it became actual law, then we can evaluate its nuggetness. But right now, it's just, it's a phantom nugget. It's just the promise of a future nugget at some point. And right now, considering what we know about the Senate, this is a great bill for them to poop on that will never actually pass. It's a wonderful bill that's not gonna go anywhere because Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema and probably some others who are even more cowardly and won't admit that they don't support overriding the filibuster prefer their myth of the filibuster more than the For the People Act. They think this fake idea that they have the filibuster that they say is gonna lead to bipartisanship, well, not a single Republican joined it in the House. How many do you think you're gonna join in the Senate? That is worth more than automatic voter registration, restoring the voting rights, expanding early voting, modernizing America's voting systems, all of that. All of that is perfectly fine and good from their point of view, but it's not as good as they when they were kids, they watched Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and they haven't been able to get past it since then. And so that's sort of depressing.
It is very depressing, absolutely.
Okay, so let's get into what's actually in this. So the bill's voting provisions would guarantee no excuse mail voting and at least 15 days of early voting for federal elections, require states to use their existing government records to automatically register citizens to vote, restore voting rights to felons who have completed their prison sentences, and mandate the use of paper ballots so that we could actually, you know, go back and look at things. All of this, especially that, should be incredibly popular for Republicans since every single one of them believes that the last election was entirely fraudulent, even if it was run entirely by Republicans. So look, we'll have a paper trail. You'll be able to find out if it was fraudulent. But you don't want to actually find out. You want to not actually know, but to be able to say that it is. Anyway, other provisions would create new disclosure requirements for dark money donations to political groups, require states to appoint independent commissions to draw congressional districts, and create new federal standards for election equipment vendors. And it's like the amazing thing, Adrian, is there's a lot in this. There's more than we've gotten to. Any one of those things wouldn't be acceptable to the Republicans. And I gotta give them credit, at least that they're trying to do it all at once. That is something. If you're gonna throw a nugget, make it a tasty one, I guess.
Yes, it seems to be very sweeping. The one that kind of caught my eye, I don't know if it's exactly on point, but it seems very, very similar in terms of disclosures for dark money, because I know California had passed that law and that is now before the Supreme Court. And we have the Koch family trying to really leverage that. And the thing is, we do need more transparency, but also, as you had initially indicated, having these provisions in place where people ensure early voting, you have these parameters that are set up, so we reduce all the things that the Republicans were complaining about in the last election. They would seem great if the true Republican agenda was to ensure that it wasn't a wholly lawful election as opposed to suppress voters. And the fact that people would have actually more guaranteed rights here is not something that the Republicans would be down for.
Exactly, and they're not. Just at CPAC, Trump in his speech said, "This monster must be stopped. It can't be allowed to pass." And why? Because there's some actual problem with it. There's legitimate concerns about how it would lead to voting fraud. No, it would lead to voting and then cut it off. That's it. It would lead to more people voting and they don't want that. And I can sort of get it for some stuff, like now early voting and mail-in voting probably does hurt the Republicans. It didn't have to. The only reason it does is because they spent a full year demonizing it. They could have just told their people to vote by mail. And they would have. Republicans vote. Republicans do actually vote. They could have benefited from this, but they prefer the lie to winning elections. It's really sick. There's some other stuff too. Tech platforms have to disclose political advertising information. There'd be a code of ethics for the Supreme Court, restructuring the FEC to add an odd number of members to break partisan deadlocks, because why would you have an equal number in a country where people just vote their party anyway? Anyway, and I wanted to also bring up, Adrian, have you been watching at all the recent Supreme Court conversations around, for instance, the out of precinct voting in Arizona? I don't know if that's something you've been tracking.
Just a little bit.
Okay, well, we don't know exactly how that's gonna go, but the Supreme Court, which has a conservative supermajority, seems like they're gonna allow those like voting suppression laws to stay in effect, despite the, you know, the clear evidence that it affects non-white voters at far higher rates. Yep. And so I'm a little bit worried about, even if this was to pass, if the Supreme Court would strike down major portions of it and things like that. I don't know if you think that that's a possibility.
I definitely think it is a possibility to carve it out. I could see that coming in the future years without a doubt, because as you mentioned, we do have that supermajority on SCOTUS and they tend to lean heavily Republican. And you know, it's like you already have the guaranteed votes there to at least get the issue before the court. And it's just, it's really unfortunate, but it hits me all the time every day that our nation was founded on the principle and ideology that white male landowners should be the one to vote. And we're still trying to reinforce that, even when we're using these veiled premises of, oh no, we're just trying to make sure voting is safe. No, we know what the real deal is and what's actually going on. And it just, it really shows me that this is not really much of a democracy at all. But it looks cute dressed up as a democracy. Mm-hmm. But when it starts to actually function like one, I like that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about another area of this. In addition to the For the People Act, there were some attempts to make it even better. So progressive Democrats in the House of Representatives unsuccessfully pushed an amendment that would lower the federal voting age to 16 as part of that voting rights package on Wednesday. The vote was 125-302. So the House was not having any of that, with the majority of Democrats voting in favor, 125-93. So that is a majority, but that is still pretty split. I mean, every Republican is gonna be against that. Young people voting, they don't want middle-aged people voting. They want old conservatives and that's it. But even Democrats, they were barely able to get the majority there. And so there's an argument for why this change should be made. Representative Ayanna Pressley said, a 16-year-old in 2021 possesses a wisdom and a maturity that comes from 2021 challenges, 2021 hardships and 2021 threats. Now is the time for us to demonstrate the courage that matches the challenges of the modern day 16 and 17 year old. And so she first introduced HD Res 23, her first proposed legislation as a congresswoman in 2019. The resolution failed after getting 126 votes back in March of 2019. So it looks like it got one less this time. So moving in the wrong direction, that's wonderful. Adrian, what are your thoughts about the argument that Representative Pressley is making there?
I think she makes an excellent argument. The fact is that in our society, we have young people who are generally driving at 16. They're expected to follow the law, but to say that they can't contribute to making it. Also, hey, we have young people who are expected to dodge bullets in an educational environment, yet they cannot choose representatives and lawmakers who would maybe make a better decision and protect them adequately. There are so many aspects of young people's lives nowadays that says that they are completely and totally ready to participate in the election process. The problem for most, unfortunately, most lawmakers is this thought that, oh, that they don't know what they're doing, that young people cannot figure out what's necessary. And also it expands the voting pool and the class of potential voters. And so to have to cater to their needs is something that our lawmakers don't want to do, since they are already neglecting our needs as adults. And you know, it really speaks to the fact that we don't have a full-fledged democracy. We have an idea of one, and that people with voices are supposed to be in a limited group.
Yeah, no, I can see in the chat, not everyone is in favor of it, and they're bringing up potential objections, reasons why we would wonder, is it a good idea to let them vote? But I want to be very clear, all of these, and I might disagree with basically all of these arguments, even that is not what is happening in the House. That vote was not a bunch of Republicans and a bunch of Democrats saying, are they really up to the challenge? No, they, like, at least on the Republican side, they don't want them to vote because they think they won't vote for Republicans. That's it. There's no philosophical debate or discussion going on. And I would say, like some people are saying, you know, someone was like, the Tide Pod Challenge would argue against letting them vote. Okay, I get it. So your concern is that young people saw the Tide Pod Challenge online and it caused them to do something stupid. Okay, well, plenty of middle-aged people believe that Hillary Clinton eats babies because of something they read online. We still let them vote. There's plenty of ignorance online to go around for all ages. I'd argue it's probably skewed older, actually, based on Facebook these days. And like questions from T-minus, so are the majority of 16-year-olds even politically conscious these days? I just don't know. Well, to that I would say, first of all, they don't have to be. Plenty of middle-aged people don't pay attention to politics. We still allow the others to vote. And I would argue that if you'd like them to be politically conscious, maybe let them vote. Like, how politically conscious are they gonna be if we don't let them interact with politics at all? So that seems like a totally good faith question, but that would be my response. I don't know, Adrian, what do you think?
No, I agree with you. I don't see any problem. And the fact is that there are a lot of adults in the United States who don't vote. So if a young person wasn't politically active or interested, they just wouldn't vote. But for those who are and want to play a role in dictating their destiny and future, my God, let them do it. Plus, we've seen a level of activism from young people, especially after these school shootings. So to suggest that young people are not involved and politically active, it ignores the landscape of what we've seen over the recent years in terms of trying to get things to change.
Yeah. Yeah, someone's like, so John wants more dumb people voting? No, like, first of all, we're never gonna stop having dumb people voting. Plenty of dumb people vote. Most people are dumb. What I want is more people voting and more people who are affected by politics, as 16 and 17 year olds are. And like Adrian said, you know, all the different things we allow them to do or expect them to do. We expect them to potentially die on foreign fields of battle. But I don't know, choosing a congressman, that's serious stuff. Let's leave that for the adults. We let plenty of stupid people vote. We let plenty of people who base all their politics off of conspiracy theories vote. Young people, at least, like, it might get them more into it. Like, it might actually, and by the way, for those who, like the Republicans who are terrified that like this would totally make it impossible for them to win with young people voting, we already know young people voted incredibly low rates. I don't even know what percentage would vote if they were able to, but that is not an argument for them to not have that right.
Yep.
Anyway, and by the way, doesn't the right always complain that we infantilize kids, that we have no expectations of them? Here's a great expectation. I expect you to pay attention to politics and I expect you to help choose our leaders. Why don't we treat them like adults if that's what you want us to do? That's not what they want. Anyway, great work. Representative Presley, thank you for pushing for this, even if it's impossible to get even the people on your side of the aisle to line up behind it. Governor Cuomo has been facing intense calls for him to resign as a result of our finding out that multiple women have now accused him of sexual harassment. And he says that he is embarrassed for the pain that he's caused, but he does not plan to resign as New York's governor. That has been made very clear. His apology has changed over time because the early drafts needed quite a bit of work. I would argue the most recent one, still pretty bad. But anyway, he doesn't need my advice because there's better advice out there for people who might have to deal with someone like a Governor Cuomo. Here is the advice for women from Jesse Waters of The Five.
She can't believe that it just gone from a normal friendly interaction to this guy's putting his hands in places that I can't believe it's happening. So I would suggest that women, and I've gotten in trouble for saying this before, you slap the man in the face and you do it immediately. Because if you wait too long, then the politician feels like he can keep doing this. And it doesn't matter if it comes out a year or 3 years later. Do it immediately when he's fresh.
Adrian, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, that idea of let me slap the man in the face, that is very 1950s. I am a huge proponent of if anybody puts their hands on you, yeah, do what you need to do to defend yourself. But unfortunately, we have these workplace settings where if I were to defend myself and I wasn't in maybe true significant danger, someone was actually just getting fresh with me, then charges could be brought against me. It would be his word against mine. And since we already have the gender power dynamics that are skewed in the world in which we already live, there's a good chance that I'd be losing my job and possibly charged with assault. So to just say, hey, if this person's getting fresh, slap them, like that isn't the way to go about it. Document the hell out of it maybe, but don't necessarily go to physical force. And because that person may slap you back. And if they're bigger than you, they may knock you out.
Yeah, this I mean, this may come as news to Jesse Waters, but he's still processing that women have to contend with a world where men harass and assault them. Wait until he finds out that men also kill women. Men seriously injure and murder women, especially, I would say, women that fight back against them. So it's terrible advice. That's the easy response. It's terrible advice for the reason that you said, that it'll probably just result in you being in worse trouble, because it is, like you said, your word against him. And the physical evidence, since you just slapped him in the face, is probably stronger for him than it is for you. So that's terrible. It could lead to you being brutalized or possibly murdered. And also, it's not the woman's duty to fight the person off. And if she doesn't do that, then he'll think it's okay. That's what Jesse Waters said. That's just another form of, it's your fault because you didn't fight back in the particular way that I, after the fact, say that you have to.
Yep.
It's not the woman's, like, yeah. What
do you think? That is very much the rhetoric when it comes to sexual harassment, especially when it's workplace professional relations. And I wrote the book, Staying in the Game, The Playbook for Beating Workplace Sexual Harassment. And in this, I address the fact that the legal standard makes it so that if you want to prove workplace sexual harassment, you have to first show that it was unwelcome. Why? Because there's a presumption that I would love your hand cupping my breast when I'm in a meeting in accounting. No, like, it should be presumed. The harasshole should have to be the one to show that they were welcome in their behavior. You shouldn't have to show that the behavior was unwelcome. These are supposed to be professional interactions. So let's assume that everything professional going down is the default rather than things that are sexual. But unfortunately, this is how it's set up, where you are already, as a woman, on the defense when you fight these things in court. And so Jesse's mentality here is actually very much aligned with the law. And that is junk.
The law should never be aligned with Jesse Waters. That's a terrifying thing. Yeah, I will say, it has been pretty fascinating to me watching Fox News deal with the Cuomo thing, because look, they've certainly criticized Cuomo, but not the way that I really would have expected. And look, I'm sure that I'm missing some stuff. I don't watch most of Fox News, but right there, he was a little bit sort of like, he's putting it on the woman. Lindsey Graham said that the Democrats should just ignore this and move past it like they did with Kavanaugh. That was his advice. Geraldo was defensive about him. And like Sean Hannity was talking with Dan Bongino, and Dan Bongino called him a creep, but he also was like, no, we have to, like, totally, you know, have like due process because you can't trust women and all this. Like, I wonder if they sort of subconsciously know that they've backed themselves into a corner, because for years they've been saying that all these women are liars and you can't trust them. And if they start to say that there should be consequences for this, the next inevitable Republican politician that's harassing or assaulting a woman might be responsible too. I don't know, maybe I'm projecting onto them, but it seems like they might get what they've been advocating for.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong at all. And we need to fully appreciate the fact that Republicans have not cornered the market when it comes to misogyny or sexual harassment, that this is something that's universal. It doesn't matter if there's an R or a D behind your name, that this is something that's more aligned with the patriarchal society in which we live. And so people want to be beneficiaries of the thought that they can get fresh or inappropriate with women. That's all a part of the power scheme. It doesn't matter what side you're on, whether you're Fox News or CNN, what may have you. And when we fully, truly appreciate that, it makes everyone's response to this make sense, because, hey, what they're doing, they're bolstering the patriarchy. That is a universal thing they'd love to support.
Okay, well, we are rapidly running out of time. So we're gonna launch into our last topic and just talk for a couple of minutes about it. Fox's second day of around the clock coverage of the Dr. Seuss Chronicles capped off, at least in my view, with this clip from Tucker Carlson, who went way beyond the other weird, obsessive cancel culture arguments that have been on Fox News, and tried to allege that those who are banning Seuss apparently are the true racists, which you'll be shocked to find out are people who are racist against white people. Take a look.
For 60 years, American children have read the Sneetches and books like it. And that's one of the reasons we have the country we have today, in which most Americans, those who don't work at the universities or for the Joe Biden administration, except Martin Luther King's most famous precept, that what matters is the content of our characters, not the color of our skins. The Sneetches affirm this. The story is a plea for colorblindness, and that's why the forces of wokeness hate it, and Dr. Seuss. When the people in charge cancel Dr. Seuss, what they're really trying to eliminate is a very specific kind of mid-century American culture, a culture that championed meritocracy and colorblindness and the superiority of individual achievement over tribal identity. These were once called liberal values. Modern liberals don't want to be reminded that they once believed any of this. If your kids are allowed to read Dr. Seuss, they will know this was a different country not so long ago. A place where people tried hard not to hate each other. A place where the population was encouraged, begged by its leaders to reject identity politics in favor of universal values and the things that connect us all.
Adrian, your thoughts?
Well, I found it to be very nonsensical, even just this initial inkling of we've been reading these things for a long time. Why do they have to go away? It's like there was a time when we used cocaine and heroin freely for what we thought to be basic ailments. And
speak
now
for yourself.
We know. Yeah, exactly. Let's maybe curb those things. And so part of me is like, just don't hold on to this old legacy ideology as opposed to saying, hey, this is rooted in racism. And maybe if we actually stand against racism, we shouldn't have these things.
I think that's a wonderful point. My God. I mean, look, overall, the incredible seriousness with which he talks about Dr. Seuss, I just love. I would also argue, Jesus, he has literally never talked about an actual political or economic topic on his show. It's like the most watched news show in the world, and he never actually engages with anything that's going on. But let's take this seriously. So first of all, my view of the conception of this particular type of American culture, where he's just talking about 1950s white culture, that's all he's talking about. But they were begging people to set aside identity politics and racism. No, they weren't. No, they were. He's talking about America pre-civil rights laws. He was talking about America that interned the Japanese. He was talking about an maybe more explicitly racist American society than we have right now, but ignore all of that because it's convenient to him. The biggest thing that the most nonsensical part of what he's saying there is that all of this stuff is not just doing what Fox has been doing, which is defend Seuss while not actually acknowledging any of the specific things that are being removed. Like, don't actually show the images or try to make a case for why it's acceptable because it's impossible. So don't try to do it. All he's talking about there is stuff like the Sneetches. Because remember, the Sneetches affirm this, which is my new favorite phrase. He's talking about a bunch of books that aren't being pulled. The books that are being pulled, he's not talking about. He's talking about arguments from ones that will still be available. They'll still be published. But he's pretending as if all of those are being pulled. And it's the thing where, like on a show like this, we would theoretically try to pick apart like some of the specific arguments that the other side is making, but he is making an argument that's 100 yards away from the actual debate, which is, should the publisher be allowed, I guess, to stop publishing 6 specific books? He's saying that wouldn't actually be fertile ground for an argument. So I'm gonna pretend that someone from the outside is forcing this and all of Seuss is being canceled, but that isn't what's happening. So how do you actually have an argument when what he's arguing can barely even make out reality from that point? Anyway, I'm probably putting more thought into this than it's actually worth, but it's not like someone's calling it a classic straw man. You can't even see the straw man. He's so far away from the actual argument there. Anyway, thank you, Adrian, for allowing this nonsense to touch your brain. I appreciate you doing that.
You're welcome. I do the best I can.
You do. Anyway, thank you so much, Adrian, as always. Where can people see more of your work?
I'm on Twitter at Adrian Law, Instagram at Adrian Lawrence.
Awesome. Thank you as always. Always glad to have you on and have a good one.
Thanks.
What does it look like when zero tolerance policies are applied at school with the new Zoom context that we've all had to get used to? Well, joining us once again on the show is the politics columnist for Insider, Anthony Fisher. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. Excited to talk about a couple of your recent articles, including one that has to do with what I was talking about in the intro, that zero tolerance policies are still being maintained in a world that is very different in a lot of ways. So what have you found in your research?
Well, I found that zero tolerance is being applied even with people not being in school. And that goes for 9-year-olds, that goes for teachers, and it goes for grad students who are adults who are doing things on their own time that have nothing to do with schools, the way they behave in schools, anything to do with their classmates. We're still treating policies punitively with no adjustments for no adjustments and no mercy really for the people involved. So some of the examples I used or I cited were a 9-year-old boy who picked up a BB gun while he was taking a test on a Zoom camera. Now that was a violation of the school's zero tolerance rules against weapons, even though he's in his own bedroom. And he was just moving something from the floor to a shelf.
Well, did anyone get shot?
No.
Is everyone okay?
He didn't point it at anyone. He did nothing menacing. He did nothing threatening. And he was almost expelled. The suspension was what they brought it down to. And there are plenty of cases like that that have happened during this Zoom COVID era. Another case was a veteran teacher nearing retirement, teaching a class from her kitchen. And she snuck a couple of puffs of a cigarette and the students let the administration know about it. She was given a suspension without pay. And then rather than deal with that indignity, she just decided to take all her remaining sick time and retire early. So in an era where we are very, very short of teachers, we've got one less because she smoked a cigarette in her kitchen. I'm not saying it was a great example.
That's against the rules?
Yes, there's tolerance for tobacco use.
Okay, so secondhand smoke is serious. I get that. What hand is a video of someone smoking in a different place? And I try not to get too down on kids. Why did the, and we don't have an answer for this. Why did the kids report it? That seems crazy to me that it was even something that was brought up.
The kids these days are really into rules and pleased to authority. But that's another conversation, which we should have. And so another, in my opinion, perhaps the most outrageous example was a 27-year-old black woman, a pharmacy student, grad student at the University of Tennessee, who dressed up as Cardi B for an Instagram picture. Now, so she was dressed, you know, risque, you know, but she's a grown woman on her own time, on her personal social media. And she was kicked out of her grad student program. I repeat, she was expelled from her grad student program because she dressed up like a very popular rapper. There wasn't any nudity. There wasn't any explicit language. It was just a risque outfit on her own time. And the school never allowed her the possibility of even being aware of what policy she violated. She was just told that this was not in the spirit of her profession.
Yeah, and so look, I think that sort of thing, we've seen instances of that before COVID. It seems what someone does in their personal social media that doesn't have anything to do with their work seems crazy to take that so seriously. I would assume that in this particular context, when everyone is having such a hard time, that there would be some accommodation, you know, a little bit more reason being injected into the process, but apparently that is not happening. Now, my worry is that in the same way that zero tolerance is bad, the way it's used is bad, but it isn't also even like doled out in an equal fashion, that when you allow teachers or administrators so much discretion to effectively nuke someone's career or someone's education, that bias and bigotry could play into that as well. Did we see any evidence of that in your work?
I haven't seen any evidence that it was based on anyone's particular identity. Like I said, though, zero tolerance, the zero tolerance makes it so that you could hide bigotry behind it because you take away the discretion of the administrators. It's the same thing in the criminal justice system. Zero tolerance rules, 3 strikes rules, mandatory minimums take away discretion. All they are mandates that you must punish somebody because of this. Takes away all real world nuance and it's bad. It's bad when it's happening in the criminal justice system and it's bad in the educational system. And I don't know who benefits from any of this. Who benefits from a 9-year-old boy being suspended
for violating a policy he probably didn't know existed in his own bedroom. Who benefits from the loss of a teacher for sneaking a cigarette in her kitchen, and who benefits from one less qualified pharmacy worker? This is all. I think the thing that's really indicative is that when bad things happen, the public often demands zero tolerance policies. Mm-hmm. And these zero tolerance policies are implemented with the best of intentions. But zero tolerance policies are unthinking and they are brutal. And they need to be avoided pretty much whenever possible because of situations like this. Because when you think you're fixing one problem, you are opening the door to creating other problems and other victims. And branding people as violators of these policies who haven't hurt anyone, didn't mean to hurt anyone, and often didn't even know they were breaking a rule.
Exactly. That's one of the worst parts of it. Well, we're speaking with Anthony Fisher, and your other article that we want to discuss today had to do with something that there's been a lot of talk about over the past year or so, and that is renaming. In this particular case, the San Francisco Board of Education's efforts to rename their public schools. How has that been going?
Hasn't been going great. There's been a lot of public outrage in San Francisco, which is, as you know, most people would know, a very historically progressive community. They're not opposed to the renaming of schools. This isn't a cancel culture issue. But the outrage has been over the fact that a disproportionate amount of energy has been spent on renaming schools, even though schools have been closed for a full year. And what the focus of my column was on a video, a public video of the school renaming committee, which consisted of no teachers and no historians, and which got their facts wrong egregiously several times. A couple of examples: a committee member said that Paul Revere's name should be removed from a school because he participated in a raid on Native American lands. That didn't happen. And she cited a history.com article, which she was reading during the meeting, and misread it.
Okay, well, really fast. So let's be clear about this. It's not just that she got misinformation online, like the wild concept that history.com could get something wrong, but it hadn't even gotten anything wrong. She just got her interpretation wrong, correct?
Exactly. And another completely bonkers example was El Dorado. El Dorado Elementary School is problematic, according to this committee, because El Dorado is a mythical city whose ruler sprinkled gold dust on his subjects. And the reason that's problematic is the gold rush apparently was bad for Native Americans, probably was, but I don't know how that's related. And also gold itself teaches kids to worship greed, teaches kids to worship, things like that, And one committee member pushed back saying, El Dorado is not a real place, and it's also not a person, and that's not in the scope of our mission here. And his point of view was rejected out of hand. So it's kind of a case where even liberals were saying we seem like parodies of ourselves in this particular instance, because the narrative of problematic names, the narrative that this is restorative justice to just slash and burn names off of schools, trumped the search for facts. And the school board's president, in an interview with the New Yorker, defended the committee's their lack of due diligence, basically saying that historians weren't really needed to be brought in, that these people were representing the community adeptly, and that we shouldn't criticize their work because they're coming from a good place.
Wow. Look, it makes it like the people who are legitimately trying to fight in areas where it might not be so easy to rename something for names that are far more clearly objectionable, it becomes harder to do that when you play into the right's attempts to frame this as a big joke when you do something that is a big joke. But it's interesting because you write in your op-ed, it's tempting to view the San Francisco school renaming debacle through a one-way cultural war lens, with woke lefties beclowning themselves in a liberal city's government unable to provide a most basic public function, but that's reductive. So explain what you were talking about there, that it isn't as simple as just that.
Yeah, it's not just a left problem. We're kind of in a post-facts era in this country where, for lack of a better phrase, the woke left is beholden to a narrative where they will sometimes get the facts wrong, and that's considered okay. On the right, the majority of Trump voters believe in a complete lie that the election was stolen. There obviously are other lies that the that Donald Trump poisoned people's brains with over the last 5 years. QAnon is a big lie that's embedded itself. But the election fraud hoax is a lie that is endangering our democracy, and it's on the right. And so the right really, they can snicker all they want at this silliness coming out of San Francisco, but they haven't cleaned up their own backyard when it comes to narrative trumping facts.
Wow. Anyway, it's both are amazing stories and about topics that I don't think nationally people know are really going on. A lot of parents are probably dealing with the sort of zero tolerance policies you talked about. But I don't have kids, so I didn't necessarily know from personal experience it was going on. But this is something that we should know about, and especially if we want to be ready to combat these same sorts of policies once kids are back in school. God only knows what'll be happening then. But as always, Anthony Fisher, we appreciate your work. And anyone watching this can read both of these articles available at Insider.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.